You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Dwight Gooden joined the New York Mets as a 19-year-old rookie in 1984, he quickly became one of the most celebrated pitchers in baseball history. In his first 3 years, he was named Rookie of the Year, won the Cy Young Award, became the youngest pitcher to start an All-Star game, and helped lead his team to a World Series victory. But during that time, he also became addicted to cocaine, and the next 25 years became a blur of drug arrests, failed rehab stays, even a prison sentence before he finally got clean on TV's Celebrity Rehab. Dwight Gooden was on our show in June to talk about Doc, his memoir of his experiences. It was a great conversation with a great baseball player, and we are re-airing it for you today. I began by noting that in the book, he writes that his father began teaching him to play baseball when he was only 3 or 4 years old, and I asked Dwight Gooden, why so young?
My dad was a big baseball fan. He grew up in a small town, Cordell, Georgia, and his dream was playing baseball. It didn't work out for him. And so he used to watch the game of the week every Saturday. We'll have a game on, and then we'll have a game on the radio. He'll have his beer and chips. I'll have my juice and cookies. We'll just watch the game at a young age. I wanted to follow him everywhere he went. So as I got about 10, he asked me one day, son, how much do you like baseball? I said, I love it. He said, do you love it enough to maybe play professional one day? And obviously, as any kid, you're going to say, of course, yes. I want to be on TV one day. And from that moment on, when he would get off work, we'll go to the park, and we'll start doing all these drills without the baseball, about balance and different things about mechanics. And he just really taught me the game of baseball.
Well, his father had been a pitcher. So did he know a lot about pitching?
He knew a lot. And I still regret that I never asked my father, how did he get the knowledge of baseball and the mechanics that it took to be a great pitcher? How did he get that? I never got a chance to ask him, how did he know that stuff at his time?
Because the mechanics are really complicated. It's release point is something that is a total mystery to anybody who wasn't a pitcher.
Yes,
and I think it's a mystery to some pitchers as well.
It's a pitcher, yes. And as a pitcher, sometimes you can be off your game by an inch and think it's a big deal. It'll be something so small that you can correct. And I talk about that a lot in the book as well. And it's something that my dad had the knowledge to do it.
But there's also factors that can't be taught, like the way you're built. You look like you have big shoulders. The muscles in your arm are probably perfect for throwing a fastball. And other pitchers don't necessarily have that. And some of us could be brilliant. We could have all the mechanics in the world and just not be very good.
That's true. It happens. And some people made out to be pitchers, like for my dad, for his knowledge. Like he knew that he wanted me to be the pitcher. And my nephew, Gary Sheffield, who lived in the same house, he knew Gary was going to be the hitter. I still have no idea how he knew that stuff, but he would work with Gary Hinton and my pitching at a very young age. He just had the ideal, and probably a big part of it is, like you mentioned, the way Will's built. I'm taller, more leaner. Gary's more physical fit.
Did he try to teach you how to be a better hitter?
Yes, he taught me hitting a little bit as well.
And better than when you went into the National League.
Yes, and me personally, that's why I wanted to be a hitter.
Now, your childhood wasn't all sweetness and light. Your older sister, Mercedes, was shot by your husband. Where were you when that happened?
I was actually in the house. It was a very domestic relationship for a long time. And it got to the point where he ended up emptying his gun on my sister. And I was about 5 years old at the time in the house. And when I heard the gunshots, and my sister was screaming for her life, I knew that I was in trouble as well as my nephew. Derek was in trouble. He was 1 year old at the time. So I just kind of grabbed him, went in the bathroom, got in the tub, pulled the shower curtain closed, and just kind of cuddled him. And just scared for our life, just waiting for him to come in and kind of finish us off as well.
Was that threat anything that was real?
The threat to us, it wasn't real.
He just shot your sister.
Just shot my sister, and we didn't come out until the paramedics and the police got there, and they came in the bathroom to get us. And what's amazing about that story, obviously today my sister's doing pretty good, but when I got addicted to cocaine, a safe area for me was always to go to the restrooms, whether it was, I was home by myself, if I was in a restaurant, on an airplane, wherever you might be, I'll go to the restaurant. And I never realized that until I did celebrity rehab, and Dr. Drew brought that to my attention on dealing with any type of trauma.
Your father used to take you along when he went to visit his girlfriend, at least until your mother found out.
Yeah, that wasn't too good.
She went after him with a gun?
Yes, unfortunately, my mom was she was one of the loveliest ladies you ever meet, but also one of the toughest ladies you ever want to meet. And she had an idea that my father was cheating around And this one particular time, she, I guess, followed him and waited there in the car. And as he was coming out of the house, she shot him in the shoulder, and she shot like three more bullets that tried to hit the woman, she told me. But she didn't get him. But from what I hear, my dad straightened up after that for a while.
Well, he used to take you along. You'd sit outside in the car with the daughter of his girlfriend?
Yes. At that time, I think I might have been about 4 or 5 years old. But I was kind of like aware as I kept going, as I was getting older, something wasn't right. But basically, he would tell my mom, I'm going to take Dwight to the store. He wants to get some cookies and chips, and we'll be back. So we'll go there, and he'll get the cookies and chips, and then we'll go sit at the girlfriend's house, and her oldest daughter come out and kind of babysit me in the car while he was in the house taking care of his business.
So did you grow up feeling that violence and gunplay were normal parts of life, and drinking as well?
I thought it was a part of it. Obviously, as you get older, you know, it's not cool to, you know, walk around and carry a gun, but from growing up around that atmosphere, definitely drinking, I thought, was a big part of it, because I remember even at the age of 12, every once in a while, I'll take a sip of my dad's beer, and that was like a cool thing to do. I'm having a drink with my dad, not realizing that I'm 12 years old and it's going to become a problem. It's not good for myself. Even with my dad, I found out later on through my problems that he actually had a drinking problem, but at a young age, I never recognized that.
You were drafted by the Mets as a first-round pick right out of high school. Did your father's training, was it always there in the back of your head?
It was always there, a lot of drills, a lot of things always stuck with me that he taught me at a young age, and it really helped me along the way. When I got drafted at 17, you know, being away on my own for the first time, playing with older guys that had been spent, you know, 3 or 4 years in college, I wasn't really intimidated by those guys because I had the confidence what my dad taught me in the way you take hitters.
So you hardly spent any time in the minor leagues?
Yes, I was, and a lot of credit goes to David Johnson. Obviously, I had a great minor league career, it was short, but David Johnson, you know, I played with him in 1983 for a little bit in the Triple A World Series. I pitched well. He said wherever he managed to make sure, he's taking me with him.
And he did.
Yeah, he did, yes.
And you were named Rookie of the Year that year. And then in 85, you won the Cy Young Award and the Triple Crown, most strikeouts, most wins, and lowest ERA. Had any other 20-year-old done anything like that?
I think the only one came close was Fernando Valenzuela, I think in 81, had that. But it's still a question out there whether he was really 21 or not. So we're not sure, but the things I did in the fashion, the way that I done it, especially doing it in New York, I don't think it had been done before.
If Julius Erving hadn't been so popular at the time, do you think that you would have been given a different nickname than Dr. K?
Well, I used to kid my friends and my teammates about when they say, where do you get the nickname Doc? I always told them from Dr. J, the way I play basketball, but that's totally false. I was just
Is that kidding. True?
That's not true. I used to get my nickname Doc from my dad's friend that was a real MD. And for whatever reason, he came to my Little League games, my high school games, and he'll have a couple of drinks, and every time I get two strikes on a batter, he'll be standing at the fence yelling. He'll be like, come on, Doc. You have another patient, Doc. Come on, Doc. Operate on Doc. And it just kind of stuck with me. We had the local paper come by and do a story, and at the same time, he was going through the whole Doc thing and wrote a story about it. And so then my teammates started calling me Doc, and it kind of stuck.
And then the K, of course, is the way you write a strikeout on a scorecard.
Yes.
And Doc is the type the title of Dwight Gooden's memoir, written with the help of Ellis Hennekin. You quickly became a favorite of the fans and the press. Now, you were 19 years old. That must have really been difficult to handle.
It was, at 19, it was a lot of fun because for myself, I didn't have much expectations. It was almost like a fan living a dream. You're playing against some of your favorite players. But after the All-Star break, that's when all the notoriety came around and the fans, the stadiums were getting packed, and it almost felt like if I was in a concert and I was an entertainer, I wanted to build them out every chance I get, but I accepted the challenge at that time.
Well, everybody wants a piece of somebody like that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, everybody that's out to get a piece don't have your best interest, and unfortunately, I found out the wrong way. Myself being a shy, quiet guy and a people pleaser, I fell into a lot of traps that way.
So from the start, people coming to you saying, hey, you want to try some drugs and things like that as well?
Situation where, you know, they might have a nightclub or bar, say, hey, why don't you come hang out at my bar, come hang out at my club, whether it's strip clubs, what have you. You know, everything is on us, just stop in. And once you do that, then the girls are there, and then the drugs are there, you know, alcohol is there.
But you also had some pretty respected elder statesmen on the Mets, Keith Hernandez, Rusty Staub, Yubi Brooks. Weren't they trying to steer you in the right direction?
Yes, they did a great job with that, but I was one of the guys where we had guys on the team that wasn't doing the right things, and for some reason I was drawn to that attention where they might come to the ballpark the next day and say, man, you should have been with us. We had five women. We had this. We had all the alcohol we wanted to drink. And right away, I'm thinking, well, where's that place? And unfortunately, I went to that place, and I fell into the traps at that point.
You and Daryl Strawberry were often portrayed as great friends since you both started with the Mets around the same time, and because it later turned out you both had problems with substance abuse. Were you at all that close?
Well, I thought at one time, maybe like when I first came into the league in 84, a little bit of 85, I thought it was pretty close. Things started to change once I started getting a lot of attention, notoriety in 85. There's a lot of finger pointing, a lot of lies that he would say about me that really changed our relationship. And even once we retired, there was still a lot of false, you know, rumors going around that he was saying. And so we had our difficulties, you know, at the time. Obviously, I still root for him and want him to do well, but it wasn't always the way people thought it was. But like you mentioned, they thought it was a lot closer because you got two African-American kids come up at the same time, very talented, had a lot of the same problems.
Both headed for the Hall of Fame.
Both headed to the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but I'm pleased to get in the Mets Hall of Fame. And that was like the closing chapter, getting in the Mets Hall of Fame in my baseball career.
When did you start using cocaine?
First time I ever used was in 1985, experimental part. Didn't really get hooked on it. 86, so not all season, really when it became.
So during your Cy Young season, you started using cocaine?
After the season was over.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it didn't affect your playing?
Right. Well, I didn't use it during the 84-85 season. After the 85 season, the off season, is the first experience I had with cocaine at that point. And unfortunately, it was love at the first sniff. And that's when I knew I should have been in trouble.
Well, some people who read this book will be thinking that you just achieved everything you'd been working for all your life. You'd been Rookie of the Year and then Cy Young Award winner. You already had a pitch in the All-Star game. Did you have any concerns that using drugs might impair your pitching skills?
At the time, I mean, you know the dangers of alcohol and drugs, what it could do. It was a situation where I allowed everyone's expectations in 1986 to take a toll on me. And the way I would medicate myself where I didn't feel the stress or anything would be drugs and alcohol, not aware of the toll it takes on your body, the damage it does to your brain, the damage it causes to your family, your friends, and your fans, everyone love you. You're not aware of that. At that point, I just felt that I wasn't going to ask for help. I was just going to, medicate myself and isolate, but it did so much damage, and you pay the price.
And you never thought, if this comes out, my career may be ruined?
At the time.
Because other people, had similar problems and made newspaper headlines.
No, you're completely right. But myself, when you're in denial, you don't see those type of things. All the signs was there that it was obviously dangerous for you from the stories you read, things that happened to other players. But when you're in denial, you never think it's going to happen to you.
This book begins with the night that the Mets won the 1986 World Series, and you write that you made two calls right after the game, first to your father and then to your dealer. So your father was in Florida, so you went to your dealer after the game?
Yeah, a situation where the night we won the World Series should have been the greatest day of my baseball career. I mean, that's like the ultimate goal and what you shoot for. And it was the greatest day for about 3 hours until the game was over. Then it became the worst day of my baseball career. And I called my dad because I knew he was watching the game back home, in satellite. Celebrated with him a little bit, celebrated with my teammates, and then I called my dealer. So it was already premeditated what I was going to do. What I was trying to do was go see my dealer, which this never happens, that you get a little bit and you come back and join your teammates at a local bar. Never made it back to the bar, obviously, and no such thing as doing a little bit.
You found yourself in the projects pretty much incapable of doing anything, and you missed the parade. What did your teammates think when you didn't show up for the parade?
Well, I would say probably 90% of them knew exactly the state of mind I was in and what was going on. Another 10% probably was more concerned with my well-being, that probably had no idea what was going on. But they knew by me not making a parade that I was in big trouble, and drugs was a big factor.
And did anyone reach out to you to try to help you?
Daryl actually was calling, and after the parade we came by to try to see what was okay. But at that time, I was so depressed, a lot of self-pity, down on myself, and guilty for everything that happened, that I basically kept the blinds closed, didn't answer the door or the phone from anybody that day.
My guest is Dwight Gooden, who has written, with the help of Ellis Hennekin, Doc, a memoir. It is published by New Harvest. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Thank you. We're back with a conversation I had last June with Dwight Gooden, who was here to talk about his memoir called Doc, a memoir that must have been painful to write because he's pretty open about some of the more terrible things he's done in his life. I started the second half of our conversation right where we had left off, in the off-season after the Mets had won the 1986 World Series. I brought up a highly publicized incident when Dwight Gooden was stopped by the Tampa police and beaten, and I asked him, what were the circumstances? Was this a matter of racial profiling?
It was not I wouldn't say racial. It was more of like athletes.
They knew who you were?
They knew who I was, and that was like the last straw for them. It had been a lot of situations where it was a lot of harassment going on for years, since 84, actually. The situation where I had real fancy cars down in Tampa, and during the daytime, you know, I would ride around where most kids at that time were in school or at work. So they pulled me over several times and ran my plates, got my license, so they knew exactly who I were. It was just a matter of harassment going on for years, and then finally in 86, during that offseason, me and a couple of friends was leaving. We just did a charity softball game at University of South Florida. We stopped by this one restaurant and had something to eat. There was a cop in there, and my friend was pretty loud, so he was like, yeah, I just got to calm down. So basically, I was like the peacemaker, calming everybody down. When we get ready to leave that place, we're going down. It's like four of us in four different cars, fancy cars. So we're going down, I think it was Fowler Avenue in Tampa. We make a left on Nebraska Avenue, and there's a cop sitting at the light, which I'm sure the cop in the restaurant probably called him in and said, those guys been drinking or what have you. So the cop car actually gets behind my nephew Gary's Corvette and throws the lights on. Gary don't see the lights, so he gets behind me. I'm driving white Mercedes with the, you know, fancy wheels and all this stuff. So the lights gets behind me, so I pull over. And at this point, I'm already, like, furious because I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. And it's, like, probably the 15th time I've been stopped. So the cop comes up to the door. He's asking me for my license and registration. I say, what's the problem now? Which I was completely wrong at that time because I should just let him talk and then just try to get his badge number. That would have been the correct thing to do. But it was just more of a build-up. So I kept saying, you know, I'm tired of you guys harassing me all the time. You know I'm not doing anything. You know who I am. You know my license plates. You know my car. He goes, another word, you're going to jail. I said, before I didn't do nothing. He goes, get out of the car. I said, you're going to jail. So when I got out of the car, when he reached, as we're talking, cop cars are steady pulling in. Unfortunately, when he reached for his cuffs, I was completely wrong, but I went to grab his wrist. Not to attack him or anything, but it's like, no, let's talk, that type of thing. So to the cops, to their advantage, I understand, when they saw me grab his wrist, they all rushed in to protect him because it looked like I was going to attack them. But once they got me on the ground, they cuffed me, they shackled me. Then they would just beat me with nightsticks, flashlights. One guy had the chokehold on me. Luckily, I had two people that was walking by. That's, you know, two white people that saw what was going on and was basically saying, why are you guys doing like that? And they said, get out of here, you're going to get arrested. Something came across me to say, plaque you out. So I plaque I was passed out. Then it was cops trying to get the other cop off me, who had a chuckle on me. So they say, he's out, let him go, he's out. So now they throw me in the back of the police car. They take me about a half mile up the road to this dog track, get me out of there. So now, before I look up, I don't know what's going on. So they get me out of there, they lay me on the ground outside. The paramedics come there. Now on the way to the hospital, they took two black officers in there, paramedics, to make it seem like it was black cops here. But when we finally got to court, my attorney did a great job and pointed out the stuff on the stands, and we sued him. We won the lawsuit, but unfortunately, by winning the lawsuit, I've been a marked man still to the day anytime I go to Tampa.
Well, but the cops were exonerated. There were riots as a result of this.
Yeah.
I mean, it was obvious that they were picking on you, but at the same time, they must have been aware of the fact that they were going to look bad going after one of the biggest stars in baseball.
I think at that time they thought that they had enough reason to do it. I mean, it's been numerous times where I've been pulled over. It's been numerous times where I had the dog search my cars. And at that point, and not that I hate cops, or I know for a fact that all cops are not bad, especially in Tampa, but still today when I go down there, and if a cop pulls next to me, I just get this bad feeling. And it's something that probably will be the rest of my life.
And then you want to go to the bathroom. But that's a whole other story. The Mets insisted that you go to the Smithers Institute for Drug Rehab at the beginning of the 87 season. Sorry.
That's all right. I like that. That's good.
Had you failed a drug test?
In 87? Yeah. What happened in 87 was obviously the whole 86 season with everything that took place for us, missing a parade, the scuff with the cops. It was a track rail in a trail there that something's not right. So when I get to spring training in 1987, I'm partying with a couple of guys on the team, and spring training is in St. Pete, but I was living in Tampa, which is about a 30-minute ride. I kept making trips to get more drugs. Finally, I said, I'm not going back anymore. And so I still think today that somebody on the team ratted me out, But, I mean, looking at it long term, they probably was doing me a favor because, you know, I was headed for destruction.
But how long did the rehab work?
The first rehab, it didn't work, and it had nothing to do with Smithers Institution. It was a great facility, great counselors there, but I wasn't ready. I was in denial, so when I went there, I was just marking a calendar for my 30 days to be over.
But then I would assume that you were tested regularly as a requirement from your contract.
Yes. After that, I actually did pretty well from 87 to 94. I did good for 7 years, but the problem was I continued to drink. I wasn't using because I knew I was being tested. By still drinking, it was just a matter of time before I was going to go back to the cocaine.
Although drinking is part of the baseball tradition, isn't it?
It's a tradition.
Babe Ruth supposedly hit some of his longest home runs after he'd had a night out.
You're completely right, but those guys were just drinking. My problem was drinking led me right back to the drugs.
And then you were suspended for the 1995 season because of cocaine?
Yes, that was a tough pill to swallow for myself, even though I deserved a suspension. But to have baseball taken away for an entire year after something I had been doing since I was 7 years old was a very tough time for me. I went heavy into my addiction at that time for about 2 months. It was just a terrible thing. Until finally I said, you know what, I can't live like this anymore. I got to get right, not for baseball, but just at least for my family. And then when I started getting right, going to the meetings, getting a sponsor, I got the call from Mr. Steinbrenner that he wanted to talk.
Now, you already had how many kids at this point?
At that time, in 1995, I had 5 kids.
So you also had to be concerned as a father.
Yes.
I don't know whether you're concerned as a role model.
Well, at that time, you're concerned as a father and a role model you are, but still, at that time, I still hadn't accepted that I had a problem with drug and alcohol, even though everything that's been going on in my life says you have a problem, but I hadn't accepted it.
My guest is Dwight Gooden. His memoir called Doc was written with the help of Ellis Hennigan. It is published by New Harvest. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the Mets had had enough of you, and they terminated your contract. And then George Steinbrenner called. You signed with the Yankees. I assume that they were aware that you had this problem with drugs.
Yes, and you bring up a good point. Once the Mets wanted to cut ties, I was a little bitter about that. Not necessarily at the Mets, but I was just felt like I don't get the opportunity to make it right with the fans as well as the Mets organization. But I was very thankful that Mr. Steinbrenner gave me an opportunity to continue my career in New York. So when I first met with George after Seattle knocked him out of the playoffs, we met at a restaurant, and we sat there for 3 hours talking, never mentioned nothing about baseball. He just wanted to know, what have I been doing for the 95 season? What are you doing with your kids? What are you doing to stay healthy? And what are you doing for yourself? What are your plans when there's no more baseball? And that was basically the conversation. So when I left that meeting, I was telling a friend of mine that set the meeting up, I said, I don't think he wants me on the team. He just wanted to know how I was doing. He said, no, he's just trying to fill you out. And so the next day he called me. He goes, do you want to be a Yankee? I said, sure. He said, okay, come over to my office and let's try to work this out. So I met with him, and my father was there. And we just basically, he asked me, what would it take? What are you looking for? And we just worked out the numbers right there and ironed out a deal within like less than an hour.
And then I say this as a Met fan who was quite bitter about this. You pitched the only no-hitter of your career for the Yankees. Your father was in the hospital at the time. Was he able to watch the game on television?
Yeah, he watched that game, and sometimes I still get choked up thinking about it because that day I was supposed to fly home. He was very sick. He was on dialysis for like 15 years. Then his heart started failing him, so we got the call he had to have emergency heart surgery, and the doctors felt that if he didn't have the surgery, he wouldn't live for a week. If he had the surgery because of his health, he probably wouldn't make it as well, but there's no choice. So I had permission to fly home to be with my dad the day that I pitched no hitter, but I had my plane ticket. But the morning I woke up, all I can do is reminisce on the days we spent on the playing field, the days we spent sitting there watching the games. I said, he probably won't want me to pitch. And so I called Joe Torre, who was the manager at the time, told him I was coming in to pitch. He tried to talk me out of it. I said, no, I'll see you tonight. Then I called my mom, who she didn't take it as well, so I had to end up hanging the phone up on her. So the first 3 innings of that game, you know, I was going in and out. Should I pitch? Should I went home? So I got teared up a couple of times. Not until about the 6th inning when I realized I had a no-hitter. I was looking at the scoreboard to see the hitters I was going to face, and you see no runs, no hits, no errors. The heart gets to pumping a little bit faster. And from that point on, you go as hard as you can, as long as you can. Once the last out was made and my teammates had carried me off the field, all I can think about was my dad. He, you know, did he watch the game? Is he doing okay? I thought about the 95 season when I was suspended. I thought about here I am in New York doing this. So I knew it was a power greater than myself that made that possible. The next day I flew home, gave him the ball. At that point, he was on life support. But his doctor told me he saw the game. After the last out, he got a one tier and, you know, tried to mumble something. I don't know what he said. So gave him the ball. Never got to talk to him. He never made it home. But the last game, my dad actually got somebody to play with a no-hitter.
Well, I've always wondered about what happens in a pitcher's mind when he realizes somewhere late in the game that he's pitching a no-hitter. Well, first of all, they're often – today, everybody's pitch count is watched. So you could be pitching a no-hitter, but throwing a lot of pitchers. And that's what happened with Santana. Yeah. He may very well have ruined his career because he just kept going. Mm-hmm. But – you got to have a certain amount of luck, don't you? Good fielding behind you.
Oh, I totally agree. Like you mentioned earlier, if I was going to guess when I was going to throw a no-hitter, it would definitely been in the 80s with the Mets where I had a lot better stuff. And the night that I pitched no-hitter, I don't think that was one of my better games. I made the pitch at the right time. There was some great defensive plays made behind me. And a couple of mistake pitches that I made, the hitter either popped it up or they hit it foul.
Were your parents aware of your drug problem?
I think my mom was aware of it. I think my dad probably looked the other way, and I said because in 1987, the first time I had tested positive, had to go to rehab, I remember I drove home, and I was telling my mom and dad that I got some bad news, and I said, I got to go to treatment, I failed a drug test. My mom was saying, "That's okay, son, that's great, now you get to get the help you really need." So she was aware of it, but my dad never said a word. He just dropped his head, and I preferred if he just told me what a furry I was or something like that, but by him never saying a word hurt me more than anything.
And then what about your nephew, Gary Sheffield?
I think they realized I had a problem after the 87 season. Before then, at times they don't know what I was doing because I was missing family events and stuff that mattered and something was going on, but they never saw me use, so he had nothing to go on.
And then you had very public problems after that. You were arrested a number of times. In 2006, you did a stint in a Florida prison. What was that for?
That was for a violation of my probation. That was one of the low points of my life, being in prison, where you go from being one of the top major league figures to now you're not even a name, you're just a number. And you're not living, you're just existing. And just horrible things you see in prison, that was one of the terrifying things in my life.
And how long were you there?
10.5 months. Mm. And at that point, you just don't know if you're going to make it out of there or what's going to happen. I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible time.
Another time you wound up in jail with your oldest son, Dwight Jr. Were you arrested together or was that just a coincidence?
Just a coincidence where he actually got arrested for possession of the cell drugs, and then I was arrested for I think the same time I had the violation. I went there, so it wasn't in the same cell, same building, but knowing that you're actually in jail with your son, where our goal was I wanted to play long enough to and see if he makes it and try to be teammates, not thinking we're going to be, you know, wearing the same uniforms in prison.
And his career never took off.
Baseball, no. It got to the point where, like a senior in high school, just too much demand, too much expectations, because he has the same name, same high school. But now he's doing very well. He's an agent, actually, now, and also he's in the music industry.
Your last arrest came in 2010 when you got into a minor traffic accident while you were driving your 5-year-old son to school in New Jersey. You were charged with endangering the welfare of a child, among other things. Did you think about whether you were endangering your son's welfare when you were driving under the influence?
At that point, I wasn't aware of it. What happened was, at that point, I was prescribed Ambien to take at night for sleeping. And I had took the Ambien about 3 o'clock that morning. My wife was aware of it, what I was taking. She woke me up about 6 and said, "Can you take Dylan to school?" She had just, at that point, had our newborn baby. So at that point, I felt like I was okay to drive to school. So when we got in the car to go, once my son said, "Dad, why are you driving in these other people's yard?" I was aware that something's not right, but I figured the school's less than a mile, I'll be okay. But unfortunately, I went another 50 feet and I hit a car. So at that point, again, when you hear those charges, you know, endangering your kid, it's very sad because, I mean, that's the last thing you want to do with your children.
And was that one of the reasons you signed on to the TV show Celebrity Rehab with Drew Pinsky? You were on with some interesting people: Amy Fisher, Sean Young, Michael Lohan.
Very interesting people, but part
Michael Lohan is still troubled. I don't know what's happened with Amy these days.
I know. It was quite some characters. My roommate, Jeremy Jackson, was one of the true guys there. I thought was really there for the right reasons. A lot of the other ones, I don't know if they're there for the attention or what have you, but my reason for going there. Obviously, I knew I needed help. And it was a situation where I wanted to remove that mask and let everybody know that, hey, I do have a disease. I do have addiction. I'm not active in my addiction, but this is what I want to do to get better. And I wanted the audience to see. So it's kind of like me removing the mask and saying, this is who I am, and I'm comfortable doing it, and I want to get better.
And this is the first time, because you'd already been to Smithers, you've been to the Betty Ford Clinic and some other rehab facilities. This is the one that you feel has taken?
I feel this one has taken, because it's a situation where obviously there's no special treatment or one better than the other. What you put in is what you get out of it, and it was the right situation for myself where I was just ready to change my lifestyle and do whatever it takes to make that change.
Now, it's probably unlikely that you're going to be in the Hall of Fame despite your incredible statistics, but if it comes up, would you want to go in as a Met or as a Yankee? After all, you pitch a no-hitter and you won two World Series with the Yanks.
Yes, I've always been a Met at heart. The Mets, I played 11 years, some great times there, and obviously that would be my goal if I was to get the opportunity to go in. And like you said, the numbers are there, but unfortunately the off-the-field stuff, you know, kept me out of it. But
have you remained in contact with some of your teammates? One of them is in prison right now, Lenny Dykstra.
Yeah, Lenny's in prison.
Did you know he was troubled all along?
Not to that extent, no, not at all. In Lenny's situation, he's still a very good friend of mine. We started in the minors together, and when he got called up to the majors, I let him stay with me. And I stay in contact with Lenny as much as I can through a mutual friend that he writes letters to. And it's a tough situation because I feel like Lenny probably belongs in a mental institution opposed to prison and get the help that he really needs to become, you know, halfway normal again.
Mookie Wilson has become a coach. Keith Hernandez is a broadcaster. You're doing a little bit of broadcasting these days. But yeah. What would you like to do now?
I like that. And I think my true passion is dealing with the youth. And I said, because once I retired from baseball in 2000, I worked with the Yankees for 6 years down in Tampa. And I did a lot of work with the minor leaguers. I was actually the pitching coach 1 year at one of the minor league teams. It was fun, but then when I work with kids and just seeing the smile on a kid's face, I get more out of that, whether it's coaching a kid or whether it's going to, you know, the correction centers with kids or what have you.
When you see a young phenom, so who you've been compared to, like Matt Harvey, do you worry for him?
Not at all. It seems like he's in the right place, and the thing I like to hear is not so much of what he's saying, but what people are saying about him. And so far, like the things that everybody's saying, that he's a great kid, he's a hard worker, you know, he's well-rounded, and he wants to get better. And it's just a matter of, with him, remembering how he got there and being aware of a lot of people that approach him might not have his best interests.
Dwight Gooden has written, with the help of Ellis Hennigan, a memoir called Doc. It is published by New Harvest. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Larry Tide talks about the history of Superman, who after 75 years of leaping tall buildings in a single bound, remains one of America's most popular heroes. And later on, Russell Banks discusses his new collection of short stories called A Permanent Member of the Family. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.